Welcome to the Beeson Podcast, coming to you from Beeson Divinity School on the campus of Samford University. Now your host, Doug Sweeney.
Welcome to the Beeson Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Sweeney, and I am here today with my friend, Dr. Timothy Tennant, who is the president of Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky, and is here at Beeson this week as our featured speaker in World Christianity Focus Week. He has preached in chapel on Tuesday, just gave another public lecture a few minutes ago in our Global Center. We've had him busy doing all kinds of things with students, and we are really grateful to you, Tim, for your willingness to be here and your great ministry among us this week.
Thank you, Doug. It's been an honor to be with you. Enjoyed it very much.
Well, I think lots of our listeners know about you already, but for those who don't, can you just tell us a little bit about your upbringing and how you came to know the Lord and how you came to learn that the Lord was leading you into ministry?
Yeah, I grew up in a wonderful Christian home in Atlanta, Georgia. My parents were faithful, godly people, and we grew up in the church. But it wasn't until I was in high school that I actually was really heard the gospel properly. And it was through a Bible study I went to, led by a Baptist layman named Clyde Fortner, who was a roofer by trade. Mm. But the Lord used him in my life, and he shared the gospel with me multiple times and led me to the Lord. Mm. And so I was actually, my main interest growing up was always in history. I'm a real history buff. I love history, and I like reading history. And so I majored in history in college. And I always wanted, people used to always say, if you're a history major, graduate school's in your future, because you can't do anything with a history major. And so I wanted to teach history, but when I was, and I was a history major in college, but when I got to my junior year, I was connected to a man named Chuck Farah, who was a theologian, a wonderful professor at ORU. And he helped prompt me and talk to me and help me realize afresh that God was speaking to my life, that he was calling me into ministry. And so I made a pivot, and I decided to go to seminary, and I never looked back. So happy.
Well, we are too. Did you go straight from college into seminary?
I did. I actually asked him, what is the best seminary in the country? And he gave me some examples, and I applied to all of them. And after a lot of prayer, I decided to go to Gordon-Conwell, and which in those days truly was a remarkable place. So glad I went there. And so I went directly from college to seminary. I met my wife there, and so it was great going there.
And you were doing at least some pastoral ministry while you were in seminary, or when did you start preaching and teaching in churches?
I did, the kind of typical guest preaching during seminary, but I didn't actually get my first appointment until I graduated in 83. So at that point, I took appointment in the North Georgia Conference, the Methodist Church. We had a four-point circuit. We led that church to become a full-time appointment. I had a great experience there in evangelism, preaching, teaching. But I always had an interest in theological education because my sixth great grandfather, which is great, 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 great grandfather, was William Tennant, who founded the Log College, and which was very important in Presbyterian church history. Of course, you would know all this, and part of the New Light, New Side Presbyterians. And so I was very interested in theological education. It was important in our family history. So eventually it dawned on me that, I might consider getting into theological education. So I was really thinking my early on to be a pastor my whole life. That's what I really wanted to do. I still love that work, but the Lord eventually led me into theological education. So,
all right. So a lot of our students are interested in figuring out, because they love study, they love theology, they love reading, they love the church and the Lord's people the most, and they try to figure out how to balance all these things. I imagine that was a little bit of a struggle for you at this season. Were you pastoring for a while before you did your PhD, or how did the timetable go?
Yeah,
for you?
I pastored for a while. Then I was involved in some mission work in Nigeria. And so I got a THM from Princeton in Islam, in African Islam. Mm-hmm. And my plan was to come back, to go full-time to Nigeria. It's a long story that got disrupted. So I came back, and I pastored a church But I taught half time at Tacoma Falls College. So I was literally driving back and forth between pastoring, and it wasn't but 15 minutes away, but it was back and forth between teaching. I was teaching theology in those days, not mission courses per se, but I was involved in teaching at the same time as pastoring for 2 years. And then eventually I went full-time at Tacoma Falls College and taught missions there. So.
Okay. Well, I want to fast forward to the present in just a minute, but I want our people to know a little bit about kind of your foundation in studying world Christianity and what was going on in your life in Edinburgh and so on, so they get a sense for how you prepared to do what it was that you wound up doing. How did you get to doing a PhD, and why did you choose to study world Christianity? That's not something most pastors think they're going to do a PhD in.
That's right. Well, I had been very early on, my very first pastorate, I became acquainted with an Indian leader from World Vision that was going back to India to start a seminary. And he came to my village where I was, my little town, and we met. And during an early morning prayer time, he asked me if I would join him and help him in India. So I worked at a deal my church where I would be I'd be in the church for 9 months. I'd be in India for 3 months. And I had this back and forth between India and my pastorate, even in my early days. And I was so interested in the church around the world. And I also realized, I think I learned a lot because I kept failing. We kept failing. Things that would work in my church just didn't work in India. And I was just so fascinated by the whole process of how the church gets embodied, how it becomes alive. I met with so many challenges and questions I never even thought about asking. And so I just became increasingly interested in the church around the world, as a young person.
Had you been to India or traveled much or done short-term missions? Or how did these connections get going?
I had been to India and Pakistan as a young person. My wife's great aunt had spent 33 years in India as a missionary.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So when we got invited to the Billy Graham Itinerant Evangelist Conference in Amsterdam, we had a real... her aunt said, "If you don't go to India, I'll never speak to you again."
So we kind of
went reluctantly.
Yeah.
We got to India, and it was just like we fell in love with it. It was amazing. So anyway, one thing led to another, and we just, kept getting involved with India. And of course, we ended up spending a lot of our life there. So it was wonderful.
Yeah. So you go and do a PhD in Edinburgh. You are able to write some more on India and further your interest there. When you were done, or when you were almost done, is that when you moved to Gordon-Conwell?
Yes, my plan was to go back to Tacoma Falls, but Gordon-Conwell interrupted it, and Kaiser talked to the president of Tacoma and said, "Can we have him?" And so they agreed. So I transitioned and went back to my alma mater. It was really wonderful. So yeah, that's when I started my first work after my PhD was at Gordon-Conwell.
And that's quite a while, more than a decade, right?
I was there for 11 years.
Okay. Yeah. And then how old were you when you got tapped to be the president of Asbury Seminary?
Well, I was only 39 years old.
So how did that work? How did they know a young kid you was ready for that job?
No, I'm sorry. I was 49 years old.
Oh, 49.
Sorry.
That's a little older than 39.
49 years old. No, I was 49 years old. I went to Asbury. It was also a big surprise because I'd been involved in this work called the Lexington Seminar for 3 years, which helped train to build academic leadership. And I was interested in leadership, and I'd always been gifted administratively, but never dawned on me that I would be involved at Asbury or anywhere else like that. But the Lord just led us, and we kind of were foolish enough to dive into it. And it's been a wonderful, amazing experience. I learned so much about theological education that I never knew. And how things work and the economics of it and the student life and all. It was just amazing. And what goes behind theological education. And I just, I could never be grateful enough for what Asbury taught me the last 15 years.
Well, the rest of us who are involved in theological leadership look at your work at Asbury with great admiration. So we're thankful to the Lord that he did that with you. Around town these days, when people talk about Asbury, we admire Tim Tennant, but we usually talk less about him than about what we've heard about the revival at Asbury. Could you tell us a little bit about it? And maybe I should let you know, I don't know if anybody's told you this week, but some of the Samford students went up to Asbury during the revival and came back, and there was a smaller scale revival that took place on Samford's campus. So there was a lot of interest here in what was going on at Asbury.
That's one of them. Yeah, it was February 8th, spontaneously a chapel at the university that was, when it ended, some about 16 students stayed, and then it just grew from there. And so I heard about it the very first day because a student ran across the lawn and burst in my office and told us there was a revival. But by the weekend, I realized this was big because it was going on day and night. And it just expanded from there. I just want to say, you know, the media only showed, as we directed them to, only the kind of crowds and all, but we didn't let them show videos or pictures of the altar because it was sacred space. And having spent, you know, dozens and dozens of hours at the altar over 16 days, I just want to say it was remarkable to see God working in people's lives. Mm. People who came to the Lord for the first time every night, dozens of people every night came to the Lord. People with marriages healed, sins that were forgiven and moved beyond. It was remarkable. And of course, I believe that, you know, I always believe altar experiences must be connected to discipleship and good, hard growth. I don't really view it as like a, you know, end all to ministry, but I do believe that God does break through at times in part of our tradition at Asbury in the Holiness Movement, where God does use the altar to come and meet his people in special ways. And that clearly happened in those days. I saw it over and over again.
Mm. Most of what we have heard in Birmingham about the revival has pertained to undergraduate students at the university and people who visited and so on. But how did it affect the seminary? Were seminary students involved?
Yeah, they were very involved. What happened was the university has one chapel that they had open, and they never opened any facility but their one chapel. And his auditorium is a good-sized chapel, but it probably seats, you know, I don't know, 600 people or whatever. So that auditorium was limited to only people from Gen Z. So if you were 25 or older, you could not get into the building.
Oh, is that right?
So they restricted it. We agreed that they should protect the movement among whom it started. Because there was a time in the first few days where students went to class and came back and couldn't get a seat because people from outside were sitting in their seats. Yeah. They have assigned seats at Asbury Chapel. So eventually we decided to reserve that space for Gen Z. And there were, of course, thousands around the country that would come from Gen Z. But there was a large group of people, they're just spiritually needy people from all over the world that came to Wilmer, Kentucky. And so the seminary, early on, I told our team, I said, our mission is to have radical hospitality. We want to be hospitable toward this. So we first opened our Estes Chapel, then our McKenna Chapel, and then our, you know, cafeteria, then our gymnasium. You know, we eventually had five spaces. So we actually were hosting more people on the seminary side as the university side.
Wow.
In terms of just numbers of people.
Yeah.
And then in addition to that, our students were involved because we had five prayer teams. And these were multiple times during the day. So you have each day, you'd have three prayer teams of around 10 people each. It's 30 people. And then every day. And so we had a lot of student involvement, you know, learning how to pray for people. Mm. A lot of people had been to seminary but never led someone to Christ before. Mm. You know, that they got to do it every night, one after the other. Every night we'd say, if you haven't received Christ, raise your hand, come down and receive Christ. So I got to see students lead people to Christ, pray for people that had burdens, unforgiveness, bitterness, a lot of shame. Young people were experiencing shame from, you know, social media and a lot of depression, things like that. So a lot of people sharing their deepest, you know, heart, and to see students interact with that pastorally when they really don't have a lot of experience with that, and as we might have, was really a part of the blessing. So we took it as a great blessing that our students got trained in hands-on ministry opportunities like that.
What a wonderful work of God.
It was 16 days of it, day and night.
Shift gears a minute here. Another thing that a lot of people in our region connect to when they think about Asbury and the Methodist Church these days is some of the division in the Methodist Church these days. There are a lot of churches in our area that have removed themselves from the United Methodist Church and either become part of the Global Methodist Church or become independent. Mm-hmm. But not everybody, particularly if you're not a pastor or a denominational leader, not everybody knows what's happened, what's going on. Could you educate us briefly? So what's going on in the Methodist Church these days, and what is the Global Methodist Church?
Right. Well, for 40 years, the Methodist Church, is, in particular the last 40 years, had a very a lot of challenges regarding issues around human sexuality mainly, and more recently in gender issues. But you know, largely it's because we have the UMC was largely developed, had embraced from 72 onward, it was called theological pluralism. So they were really open to a lot of divergent ideas, and so it created increasing tensions with a more evangelical voice within the Methodist Church. So Asbury has generally been the main seminary that serves the evangelical wing of the Methodist Church. We're not a Methodist seminary, like official Methodist seminary, Methodist seminary. We are independent, and serve a wide variety of denominations. But it has been difficult because these years are the years when finally a new church was formed, and they created at the last conference, a general conference Methodist Church. They created in 2019 a special provision which would allow churches to leave the denomination if they fulfilled certain obligations regarding, you know, pensions and apportionments and various things. So this paragraph that was passed has become a famous paragraph, you know, in the Methodist circles, because it's basically a roadmap to allow you to leave the denomination, because the Methodist Church has a trust clause, which means the denomination owns your property and your building. So even if you paid for it with your yard sales and people's tithes and offerings, it still belongs to the denomination. So that created a big challenge. So this gave a more favorable pathway. And so because of that, thousands of churches, over 3,000 churches, took advantage of that and left the denomination. And that's what's caused a lot of in the media and so forth. But it's been going on slowly for many years. And I think Asbury, at one time, when I first got there, probably half our student body were United Methodist. Mm. But that number had been dwindling over the years anyway, and we've picked up new groups. And so I don't think it's going to impact us dramatically, because the people that mostly came to us are now part of the Global Methodist Church. So what happened, there have been United Methodist churches that went to the Wesleyan Church and the Free Methodist Church, but the largest group has gone to a brand new denomination called the Global Methodist Church, which was founded just a year and a half ago. And that church has not yet had its first general conference. It'll happen in September in Costa Rica. And that'll be the founding conference, like what we call it. The Christmas Conference is the famous founding conference for the Methodist Church in the 18th century. This is their version of that. So this is going to be a really important conference where we'll officially establish what the discipline will be and the doctrines and the theology and so forth. But it's made up of a very strong evangelical contingent of the Methodist movement.
Yeah. And as a seminary leader, a theologian, and so on, who is now in the Global Methodist Church, what are your hopes and prayers? What kind of influence are you trying to have as the Global Methodist Church kind of comes to be?
Yeah, we hope that they are not simply reactive to problems. I think it's important not to say, you know, we're the church that is against certain problems in society and in the church, but rather to say, what are you for? What is your vision for really being the New Testament embodied church in the 21st century? I think it's really important that they not just be a collecting denomination for people that are disaffected United Methodists, but I said to them many times, if in 10 years, half of your members say that they don't remember the days of this, you know, separation split, then, you know, you've not done a good job. We want to have a lot of growth with church planting. Asbury's done a lot of money raising money to help the GMC plant new churches. And so we have a partnership which allows not just with the GMC, but many other groups to help them to plant churches effectively and to greet new members. So my greatest hope is they would be fully Wesleyan, not just generically evangelical, that they would be fully engaged in church planting, and they would be global and be really a global Wesleyan movement, not just a local one. And so that's my hopes and dreams, and it could all very well happen, you know, without God's providence.
Yeah, we're praying with you about it. Okay, so this has been a wonderful week for Beeson Divinity School, because you've been here among us giving our World Christianity lectures. By the time our interview here drops, we'll have edited versions of your chapel sermon and today's lecture available so that our listeners can tune in and watch these lectures or listen to them themselves. So I'm not about to ask you, so give us the lectures. But can you give us just a little teaser? We want to interest our listeners in tuning in and watching them. What are they going to get if they do?
Well, the lectureship, the main lectureship that happened today was based on what can we learn theologically from the rising global church around the world. And so we often think about the church around the world being different culturally or whatever, but trying to understand how it affects the way we do theology, the way we talk about doctrines of the faith, like the atonement or about, you know, the life of Christ in different contexts. So that lecture is talking about the growth of the church around the world and the implications of it for how we think about theology.
And you're making a pretty big claim, which I affirm wholeheartedly. Can you give us the short version of the thesis from today?
The short version is that we, now that the Western world is the minority Christian, part of the Christian world, Christian movement, we need to do a lot better job listening to the global church because they're writing and saying some really amazing things that can help us strengthen our own faith and our own writings. And I've always believed that every church has unique insights and blind spots. And that's true for every church on every continent. So we can help them strengthen their work and they can strengthen our work.
Yeah, amen. And so if there's some lay folks listening here who every once in a while come to the seminary and hear talks and so on, but don't have as good a sense as you do for how they might learn a little bit more about what's going on, even theologically around the world, what could they do? Are there websites you'd recommend or introductory books they might check out?
Well, there's been some nice introductory books by Philip Jenkins that has been popularized. We jokingly said when his books kept hitting the New York Times bestseller, well, we've been saying these things for years. Our books never hit the New York Times bestseller. Well, because we weren't writing to people the way that he can write to people.
Sure.
Or so his book, you know, he has several books on the new faces of Christianity or on the growth of the global church that would be just Philip Jenkins. I think it's probably one of the best just kind of basic introductions for a layperson to see what God's doing around the world today.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Tennant, we always end these podcast interviews with the same question. And the question is, what's the Lord doing in your life, teaching you these days? And of course, the reason we end in this way is we want to end on an edifying note for those who are listening. But the premise is, even these world-famous theologians and seminary presidents we bring to Beeson, who've been walking with the Lord for years and years and years, are still growing in the Lord, are still learning things. And so what's he doing in your life? What are you learning these days?
Well, thank you. Yes, these have been good years of growth for me. When I came to Asbury, I think it was in my third year that I realized that I needed to go deeper to handle the capacities that were asked of me. And my wife and I decided to get up an hour early every day and start. We would do a 150-day experiment and sing through the Psalms for 150 days. And we did that in 2012. And we got to the end of it. We said, we can never stop this. It's just too enriching. So we've done that every day since 2012, including this morning.
That's great.
We do it on the phone if I'm traveling like this. But I found the Psalms has really helped me a lot. And I think in more recent years, you know, when I left I'm leaving Asbury in a few months, and I've realized how much my identity has become so wrapped up in my job, in my work. And I think it's, that happens to pastors, it happens to all of us. But I feel like particularly in this role where I became, I was just the president, you know, and so I think the Lord really has been working my life the last year and a lot through the Psalms to remind me of my core identity in Jesus Christ and that he loves me just because I'm his child, not because I've done something for him. And I think that's been good for me. It's been good for me to kind of reclaim and be refreshed and just what a joy it is that my name is written in heaven and I belong to him and I don't have to do something to make him happy or pleased, but I just want to rest in him. So God's been doing a lot of good work in our lives and just reminding us of what it means. I know it sounds so simple, but what it means just to be a child of God.
Yeah. What a wonderful word, wonderful way to end. You've been listening to Dr. Timothy Tennant. He is a lot of things, a student of world Christianity, a theologian, a missionary, a pastor, president of Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. We're grateful to you, Tim, for being with us this week. Your ministry has been wonderful. Listeners, we're always grateful to you for your prayers, for our students especially. We're praying for you too. We love you, and we say goodbye for now.
You've been listening to the Beeson Podcast, coming to you from the campus of Samford University. Our theme music is by Advent Birmingham. Our announcer is Mike Pascarello. Our engineer is Rob Willis, and our show host is Doug Sweeney. For more episodes and to subscribe, visit beesondivinity.com/podcast. You can also find the Beeson Podcast on iTunes and Spotify.